Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Jody Hyman is a professor in the Faculty of Medicine and Arts at McGill University, where she is also the founding director of the Institute for Health and Social Policy. Dr. Hyman has consulted widely to global organizations and is founder and director of the Project on Global Working Families at Harvard University. She is the author of the recently published book, Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder. Jody, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In your book, you feature a number of case studies. You tell some really compelling business stories about companies that attribute their success not to the actions taken at the top of the corporate ladder, but rather to those that are on the much lower rungs of the ladder. Who are some of these companies, and are they large? Are they small? Are they companies we've heard of?
They're every kind of company. When we started this study, we really wanted to explore who were those companies that were bucking the trends, that were in fact investing in the lowest level employees in their corporation, and what was their experience? Was this too costly? Were they doing well by it? So we looked at companies from small ones, 27 employees, to large firms with 126,000, from those that were local to those that were truly global with branches in dozens of countries around the world. Some of these are names readers would know well: Costco, American Apparel. Others are companies that are likely to be new to our listeners: Great Little Box Company, Dancing Deer, Novo Nordisk. About half are in North America and half are around the world: Europe, Africa, Latin America, and Asia.
How can companies profit by investing in their entry-level employees?
What we found was the firms were investing in a wide range of ways. Some of them were markedly increasing wages. Others who couldn't increase wages increased assets. They would profit share. They would give stock options at the bottom. Many were investing in health. Almost all had a way to do something around training and career advancement. Career advancement in particular is usually relegated only to those who start their careers already with a very high level of education. But these firms were doing it for everybody, including those with the least formal education. The reason these different ways work is in every case they were engaging employees. They did it in a way that made their employees care more about the profitability of the firm and contribute more, not only in their time and energy, but in their ideas and what would save money and what would make the processes more efficient and effective.
Tell us a little bit about dealing with the frontline employees, the people who are literally closest to the customer, where it would make the most sense to invest the time and effort, not only in their skills and in their training, but in their infrastructure, in what kind of technology, in what type of systems they might be using or processes to support them. It makes sense, but people are almost afraid to make that type of move because it seems so non-traditional.
That's absolutely right. On the one hand, it should seem obvious. You would figure out who is delivering most of your product, who is doing most of the work, and that's where you would invest. On the other hand, what firms have been told and what has been the common accepted wisdom is that those employees who come with the least formal education, who are entering at the bottom of the corporate ladder, are expendable. You can readily replace them, so why would you invest in them? If you have to cut money, cut there. What the firms that are profiled in Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder demonstrate is, in fact, how rich the wealth of firm-specific knowledge is, how strong those skills are, and what an enormous difference it makes to productivity and profitability to invest there.
But many of the people in true strategic leadership positions are not going to understand how an industry leader, and you mentioned a couple names already, can pay wages that are as much as 40% higher than their primary competitors, and at the same time not require their employees to contribute a huge percent to their health benefits and other support systems, and still do well in terms of profit and stock value. What's the secret there?
It is a phenomenal story because it is a total win-win for the country, for everybody working at these firms, and it's a big win for the shareholders and the CEO. So how's it work? There are two different ways. One is that a number of the firms link the higher wages to productivity. This should be straightforward, but again, this is something typically done at the top, not at the bottom.
I think you're absolutely right. So can you give us some examples?
American Apparel used to have a very mediocre level of productivity in their factories. They had a new COO go in. He saw what was going on, put in teamworks and incentives for these teams to produce more effectively, higher wages when they produce more. Within 3 months of the redesign, which had those two elements, with only a 12% increase in the labor force, they had a 200% increase in productivity. The wages went up 50%, fantastic for the employees, but at a productivity threefold, the firm was the one who was really making the biggest gain.
Yeah, right.
Across the country, Alabama, Jenkins Brip, linking whether you can lift bricks off a conveyor belt fast to how much you're paid, workers were making $24, $25 an hour, an enormous wage for unskilled labor, but the firm was making more because of the productivity. Last example, important one, Costco does not have these direct links. The wages just go up. Cashiers were making, after 4 years, over $40,000 a year. Now, why did it work there when it wasn't a direct link? Because the loyalty was so high that they kept their best employees, they did work hard, they created a better product. The better product attracted more customers, so in the end, they were making more per square foot and more per employee than Sam's Club, the Walmart model of how you pay and treat employees.
It's interesting. The Costco model is also based upon their primary source of revenue being membership, whereas the Walmart Price Club type of thing is based on the revenue they take from the product sales. So given the Costco model, this investment in frontline employees, the people who are closest to the customer, completely makes sense.
It makes you realize how what we've been doing nationally and globally much more commonly is doubly costly, because it's cutting wages, cutting benefits to working women and men who desperately need them. But at the same time, it's making firms less effective at what they do.
Right. Now, what kind of response do you give to people who say, that's all good and fine, Jody, but I've got this building full of people in Bangalore that can get this done for nickel on the dollar, or I can go to Shanghai?
One of the important things we did was go to firms in China and in India to see what they were doing. What we found is that the same model was more productive there. Novo Nordisk, European pharmaceutical company operating in China, but even there where they didn't have to have better benefits, more opportunities for training, et cetera, they put it in place voluntarily. Why? Because it led to so much lower turnover. Having better engagement, better training, instead of having the Chinese average of 24% turnover, they had 9%. Why does that matter? It matters because of quality of product. That's obvious for a pharmaceutical company, perhaps, but we've seen what's happened to toy manufacturers, toothpaste manufacturers, those who, when they go to other countries, don't worry about quality, and quality is directly linked to employees.
Got it.
Now, what about firms who are operating in higher wage settings and worried about the jobs going to lower wage settings? One of the firms we studied was Autoliv Australia. They're in the automobile parts manufacturing business. We know how tough that business is right now to be in any advanced economy. But they introduced flexibility options, which didn't cost them dollars, but meant that they had more committed workers who stayed longer and who had cross-training that helped them when the competitive market and economic downturns meant they had to readjust.
Your book also examines the importance of training as a key component of investing in a company's workforce. Here at the AMA, we see when the economy weakens, training is the first thing cut. They don't even think about it. Now, your research demonstrates that this is a big mistake. Yet, as we often hear from managers, they have a difficult time demonstrating the business value of training. What advice can you offer them?
In nearly every company we went to, training played an incredibly strong role. What varied is what training they could afford and how they decided to spend their training money.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Could you expand on that?
Let me just give two examples.
Okay.
Dancing Deer, bakery, startup company in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. found what they really needed to do was train line workers in the bakery in English as a second language. They had immigrants from a wide range of countries, not effectively communicating with each other. They all very much valued the opportunity to have the English training, markedly improved productivity because it improved communication.
Right.
A very different model. Isola, manufacturing roofing materials had to mechanize their factory. They had a choice. Do you let go all the employees who don't know how to use computers and hire anew, or do you do training? And they did an immense amount of training at the bottom of the ladder. What they found was they reaped all sorts of benefits they didn't anticipate. They got what you might anticipate. The workers did their job better. They knew a lot about how the factory operated, what should be the quality. But they also found, because they simultaneously put in this team system where these highly trained workers were responsible for each other's jobs, that absenteeism rates declined by 28% over the summer, 39% over the winter, enormous gains they hadn't even anticipated.
Now, in the book, you outline five clear steps organizations can take to profit together with the employees at the bottom of the ladder. Can you walk us through those steps?
Number one, understand who performs the majority of the essential work at the firm. If you're in manufacturing, it's those on the factory floor. If you're on a call center, it's those answering the phone. If you're wholesalers and retailers, it's the staff who are selling, who are cashiering, who are stocking. That means in most firms, this is everyone at the bottom of the ladder. Step number two, realize that your success depends on the quality of the work of those who are carrying out the majority of the labor. Should be obvious, but often isn't, and hasn't been where the investment is. Number three, once you've realized that, it should be clear that having healthy, well-prepared, well-trained workers who are motivated to do their work is going to increase your productivity.
But how can leaders do that?
Making sure you've invested in health, making sure that workers aren't getting injured on the job, making sure that they are compensated in ways that motivate them to be more productive, all make a dramatic difference.
Right.
Number four, not forgetting that it's the line workers who often know best how to increase the efficiency of the operations. One of the things we were struck by time and again is that the most profitable firms had figured out that if they're running a factory, it's people on the factory line that can tell you where the errors are being introduced, how to make things more rapidly. And if you're selling wholesale, it's the people in the store who can tell you what are the roadblocks to being able to have more customers. Finally, recognize that these same factors influence the quality of your work around the globe. So if you're going to have manufacturing in other countries, if you're going to have sales in other countries, it's not that these matter only where your home base is. These are going to matter in every country you operate in.
And Jody, just as a concluding question, why would you say the concepts you propose in your book are significant now more than ever as we pull ourselves out of this recession?
I think they're markedly more important now. They're more important to those who are working because families have lost a lot of assets. Jobs are more vulnerable. Wages have gone down in many sectors, so the need has been magnified for employees at the bottom and middle of corporate ladders to have better working conditions. At the same time, of course, companies are under enormous pressure to try to find ways to be profitable. They need to figure out ways to do it and can't be increasing benefits and wages unless it makes more money.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is it does when done well, and that's what these firms in profit at the bottom of the ladder demonstrate. They illustrate the mechanics of doing it well. There is a way to address both the financial crisis the firms have seen and the economic crisis that families have faced. And equally important, the crisis in confidence in corporations across the country and around the world. And I think these companies demonstrate that we all have a shared best interest.
We've been speaking to Jody Hyman, author of a new book, Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder. Jody, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Join the American Management Association group on LinkedIn to share insights with hundreds of your management peers and to discuss practices in the areas of organizational management and leadership. To find us, simply search for the group American Management Association from your LinkedIn account. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.